The best of the best. This is Aviator Cast, episode 107.
Calling all aviators, you've landed at Aviator Cast, the top podcast resource for interviews, refreshers, lessons, training topics, and more. Join weekly and share in our passion for flying things, exploring the rare air through flight. And now, another episode. Pre-flight complete, fuel on board, and flight plan filed. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Here's your host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. Take a page out of any aviator's book and you'll find a rich history of hard work and a bunch of fun flying. No matter who you are, no matter what part of the world you are in, flying is an adventure, and where you fly is a unique and beautiful place. Embrace it. So welcome to this, the 107th episode of Aviator Cast. It is my absolute pleasure to have you here. Aviator Cast is brought to you by Aviator Training by Angle of Attack, offering online ground school wherever you are and flight training in Alaska. Turn your aviation passion into reality. Get started at aviatortraining.com. So again, welcome. If you've never been here to Aviator Cast before, we are all about flying. We are all about aviation passion. I interview a lot of different people on the show from all different walks of life. I've been on this kick recently of interviewing fellow flight instructors of mine from around the nation. And it's just been a really good kind of stream of episodes. So we're going to continue that today with another instructor, a very special instructor. Of course, I always bring you special instructors. But here, if you are looking to get into aviation, or you're looking to stay in aviation, or you aren't quite progressing through like you'd want to, but you still want to stay connected, Aviator Cast is a place where you can do that. I think that is why most people listen. They just want to stay connected to the community and keep that passion alive to keep moving forward. And that's what we're all about here. I know that I do this podcast for similar reasons, because I need that injection and that reminder of why I'm doing this. And so this is a great place to do that. It's a medium that you can listen to kind of passively while you're working out or driving or working, whatever it is. And I hope you guys end up enjoying it no matter where you are, no matter how you're listening to it. I hope you enjoy it. On today's episode, we are going to talk to Zoanne Hark-LaRode. I met Zoanne recently at the Redbird Flight Simulation Training Conference in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And it just so happens that her and I were teamed up in kind of a team building exercise. So I got to know her a little bit through that. And then later on that evening, come to find out, she won the AOPA National Best Flight Instructor Award. So here, I didn't really know that she was this amazing instructor, but you know, there are so many amazing instructors out there that deserve this award. Zoanne actually got the award for 2017. So I asked her to come on the podcast and talk for a little bit about her journey. It's pretty unique, so I think you guys will like it. Before we get into that interview with Zoanne, as always, I read a review from iTunes, Stitcher, or some other location where you guys leave a review. If I do read your review on the show, then I will send you an Aviator Cast t-shirt. All right. So this episode this week, or rather this review this week, comes to us from Brian Nordella from the USA on Apple, and he says, or on Apple Podcasts, and he says, incredible aviation podcast. Aviator Cast is an incredible aviation podcast. It's extremely informative and entertaining. Chris does an amazing job at not only being able to show his love and passion for aviation, but also pass on his knowledge for it as well. I would definitely recommend this and his YouTube channel to anyone who is interested in any field of aviation. Brian, I really appreciate your review. I'd like to know more about your journey through aviation. So go ahead, email me at aviatorcast.com. I'll tell you from there where you can go to get your t-shirt, and then you and I can converse a little bit more. So thanks, Brian. Really appreciate that. And if you want to leave a review on the show, I have a way of getting those reviews. So just go leave one on iTunes or Stitcher or one of these other services, and it'll pull into the service that I use to look at those. OK, Okay, so a couple of cool things that happened this last week. I did have that great interview with Trace Clinton. He and I are talking about some potential future opportunities. And then I released another episode of the Angle of Attack show that is available on YouTube. It documents my journey through commercial pilot training. Of course, I'm a CFI now, but it shows kind of the hard times I had going through my commercial pilot training. Now, I did some podcasts on that before, some pretty thorough episodes chronicling what happened, but now you kind of see it in a condensed video form that you guys can see on YouTube. So go ahead and check that out. You can also find that on aviatortraining.com if you want to view it from there. Either way, I think you guys will enjoy it. It gives an insight into what training to be a commercial pilot is like. So that is it. Just a couple quick notes here. And now we are going to get into Hangar Talk with Zoanne Hark-LaRoad.
Now, another great guest on Hangar Talk.
All right, everybody. We are very honored to have a special guest with us today. We have Zoanne Hark-LaRoad with us. Zoanne, how you doing?
Hey, Chris. I'm doing well. Thank you so much. How are you?
Perfect. I'm doing great, too. You and I actually met in kind of a serendipitous way. We met at Redbird Migration, where they had this team exercise, and they said, okay, go to your table number, and you guys are going to make a video together. You ended up being one of my team members, and that's how the stars aligned, I guess.
I guess. And that was awesome because, you know, thanks to your expertise with the technology and being able to edit our videos and coming up with a good plan, we actually won.
Yeah, we did. We got valedictorian. We got a little Apple trophy.
Yes.
Pretty fun.
I'm so proud of that trophy.
It was pretty good. So let's tell first a little bit of who you are, what you're doing right now. And then as we do with everyone, we'll rewind the clock. So what are you doing right now, Zoanne?
Sure. Right now, I'm one of the assistant chief instructors at a military aero club in Colorado Springs. We're known as the Peterson Air Force Base Aero Club. So we're part of that aero club, military aero club system. And I showed up here one day and was they asked if, and I was just going to rent their airplane, sell my airplane. I moved to Colorado Springs. I didn't figure that I needed an airplane because I didn't live out in the rural area. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, just going to rent their airplanes. And I thought, well, you know, being right here in Colorado Springs, they're right next to Schriever Air Force Base. And Schriever is the one that controls the GPS constellation. I just thought for sure that they would have, you know, screens in every cockpit and, you know, all of them would be equipped with GPS. And oh my goodness, the first day I got here and went to check out in an airplane, it had one old NavCom radio in it and that was it. We didn't have a transponder and an intercom. But
like, oh, wow.
Okay, I think I'll keep my airplane for a while longer. But the manager came to me and, you know, you fill out your paperwork and so they can find out everything about your flying history. And she discovered that I was a flight instructor and she asked if I would, you know, if I was still current and what my pass rate was and all that, and said, would I teach there? And I said, yeah, you know, I'd be happy to help you out if I could. And that was, I think, 8 years ago and I'm still here and still having a lot of fun. So.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure there's plenty of history in the book of Zoanne that we're going to go through on this episode, but let's rewind the clock to the very beginning of that book. How is it that you first fell in love with aviation? How did you get into it?
Well, I lived in Kansas City at the time and we weren't too far from, that was when TWA was still in existence at Trans World Airways, former Howard Hughes company. And so a lot of my, friends in school, they were associated. There was an overhaul base there for TWA aircraft in Kansas City, North part. And a lot of my friends were connected with Transworld Airlines. My neighbors, you know, worked on the interiors and there was, you know, pilots that went to our church. And it happened that when I was in high school, I dated a guy who was, I think, taking flying lessons at the time. And he would take me up flying, which I know now, you know, he probably shouldn't have done. But his dad was also one of the Czech airmen for TWA. So I'm sure they kept, you know, he had access to airplanes and they had some private property outside of town and had a runway and strip on that. So I'm sure he'd been flying for quite a long time and, you know, just trying to do everything the correct way. But yeah, right then and there as a high school sophomore, I was like, oh man, I want to do this. One thing led to another. I had to finish school and try to earn some money and try to get some time available. And it wasn't until after I'd gone to college and met my husband and married him, and we started to make a little bit of money, pay off some of those loans.
Right.
Have to do for college, yeah. So I finally got enough time and money where I could work and go out to the airport, once a week before work. My husband and I had actually moved to Phoenix, Arizona, when I started flying. And I was at a photo shop. We used to have to take film to a place to get it developed. Mm-hmm. And this photo shop was just a few blocks from our house. So I'd taken some film down there. And the owner of the shop had some pictures of airplanes and was all too happy to talk about flying.
Great.
Of course, none of us pilots are happy to talk about flying, are we?
Yeah. Well, yes. Here we are talking about it right now. So yeah.
Here we are. Yes. So, he invited me to go down to the airport and take a lesson with him. And he was willing, he had a business he had to run. I had a business I had to go to help pay off loans from my husband's graduate school. And it took me, 6 months, maybe a year to get that first private pilot certificate. And then another year and a half just to get experience and have some fun. And then my husband was working and out. So we were two incomes, no kids. And he came to me one day and said, do you want to stay in the sales business? I was in sales working for one of the major hotels in Phoenix there. And is there something else that you'd like to do now? Because, you've put me through school and I'd like to help you do what you want to do. And I go, I'd really like to see how far I could go in this aviation thing. We'd taken several trips across the country, and from Phoenix, we'd go to my parents in Kansas City or his family up in Denver, Colorado.
As a private pilot, right?
As a private pilot.
Right.
Of course, in Arizona there, we were really close to Southern California. So that was another trip we'd take. And working for the hotels, we'd go into Anaheim or Fullerton or Buena Park, and we'd stay at the hotels there and go to Disneyland. Knott's Berry Farm and do those fun types of things. We had friends that had a boat in San Diego, so we'd fly into San Diego, Lindbergh there, and walk across one of the hotel shuttles to pick us up, and then walk across to Seaport Village and go out on one of the yachts with our friends. And
perfect.
We were having a great time.
Right, right.
Goofing off, and that's what I did for that year and a half, since the instructor that I worked with, he would only do private pilots. He didn't really keep up with the instrument and the commercial. At the Scottsdale Airport was one of these accelerated flight schools where you could get in and get your ratings really quickly. So I was able to get all the way through to flight instructor between about May of 89 and all the way to October 10th, got my flight instructor rating. And
wow.
They needed to hire pilots right away. Normally you had to have a double I, but they went ahead and hired me anyway because they, they needed instructors. And it took me until like February to get my double I. That was kind of a fun story.
Yeah,
because you're so busy, yeah. Yeah, major flight school you were. So they actually assigned me in January two instrument students, and they said, okay, by this date they will need 10 hours with a double I. You need to have your double I by this time. I said, okay. So that's a whole nother story about how I almost missed that, but that worked out. So,
great. Yeah. Well, that's kind of an interesting transition. I think you went through what a lot of people go through, where they fall in love with it first. And then life kind of gets in the way. And then later on, after they've, done some work and maybe things free up, they can finally go for it. It's really interesting that you decided to go for the career side of it.
Yes.
So from there, you became an instructor. It sounds like you did CFDI, CFII. And then how did things progress from there?
Well, I got the MEI. And again, at this flight school, we were getting 1,000 hours a year.
Wow.
Between what we were training and what we were teaching. And I also then, through my husband planting a lot of seeds, was able to be a partner in a twin Comanche. Mm. And so I'm coming up on 1500 hours and, wanting to get an ATP because opportunity and another opportunity to one of these waves that we typically go through, like we're in now, where they desperately need pilots.
Right.
And the guys had all pretty much got the folks from the Vietnam era into the cockpit, and then the next wave that happened in the early 90s of needing folks. So I want to catch that. And so I was able to be a 1% owner in this twin Comanche, and I put 300 hours on that.
Oh, wow.
And in the space of a year. And that's what I took my ATP in. And
great.
That was a great party while that lasted. And then I was on my way to the airlines, and we found out we were expecting our first child.
Oh.
And then we had to decide at that point whether, you know, we were going to raise our child ourselves, or if we were going to hire that dentist, so to speak. I mean,
right.
Some folks have to, but we actually had the opportunity to choose mm-hmm. what we wanted to do. And so I go, well, you know, I'd like to try to do that for a while. I can always come back to this aviation thing.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, flight instructing really gives you a lot of flexibility. And by that time, I was just really appreciating the flexibility. So I called the company that had offered me a class date. I had a class date in May, but this child was coming in October. And so they said, well, let us know when you're ready to fly. They were pretty good on their class. So they really weren't like they are now, where they're, you know, hey, you know, we'll work something out for you.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I continued to instruct until I instructed on Friday and had that first child on Monday. And
so that's so
I figured
cool.
as long as I could flare, what's the problem?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, so, exactly. Your seat was probably rolled back a little bit. You probably were doing rudders with your tippy toes, huh?
Not really.
Not too bad.
I could slide underneath pretty easily.
So. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Good. And then we were an older couple at that point, and so I was in my 30s when I had the first one, and so we had the second one not quite a year and a half after that. And I'm getting ready to fly one of my students. Just on a short 105-mile cross country and back. And my husband says to me, I don't think you should take that flight, because, you know, the child's due the next week on the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, okay, well, my husband is also an aviation medical examiner, so he's doing the flight physicals for, everybody around the club and stuff. And so I asked him, I said, are you asking me that as my concerned spouse, or are you asking me this question as my aviation medical examiner? Because at the time he could do my flight physicals.
Right, right.
And he goes, he's brilliant. He goes, which one would have the greater impact? And I gave a kind of a humph, and I guess I'm not flying to on this cross country today. But
that's funny. That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, what was it like juggling being a new mother and flying? Because, you know, even with how flexible aviation is, or being an instructor rather, it's still got to be pretty difficult, especially just getting into it. We just had our first child a year ago.
Yes, Apollo. Yes.
Yeah. And I'm just the father, and I didn't do all the work that my wife did. So I'm kind of curious from the mother's perspective how that all worked out.
Yes. My obstetrician also worked with a lot of pilots, and particularly flight attendants, and he had some ideas about, you know, when you should fly and when you shouldn't. And he was like, you know, as long as you feel comfortable, he was fine with that, because the baby's going to get theirs first. But once the child came, again, I'm still working for this accelerated flight school where they're getting a lot of pilots in and out. And that was really a wonderful blessing. Our primary customers came from like Denmark, Norway, Sweden. We had a few Polish students by now, and particularly the Danes. They were culturally into the family leave, and then also to one of the spouses, and it didn't matter which one, but one would take care of the kids. And of course, I've got these people as my students, and I'm familiar with their families. I go to a few of the parties with them,
right?
And they were so kind and generous to take care of the first daughter and then the second daughter. And so it really became quite easy. They were taking care of their children and some of the others, their friends in their groups as well. And they would even bring the girls to me for my lunch break. And, you know, we would do things with them, for the hour and a half, 2 hours that we had between flights. So it could not have been a better situation.
Yeah. So if I understand it right, your students' families were watching your kids during the day while you were flying with their right. With the students
with one of the yeah with one of their wow. One of their other kids and, yeah
and that is so cool.
Our daughter, since she was actually with yeah one of the Danes, and I guess nai is their word for no, so her first word for no was a nai. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna pretend like I don't know what that means, right?
That's great. Yeah, wow. Parent,
but it was wonderful.
Yeah, I've never heard of anything like
a better
that
situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Perfect. So did you end up having two kids, or did you go on from there and have more?
Just the two.
Okay,
the
perfect.
Two. Yeah, it was great. And and then by the time that they were in school, that was another real easy thing to just work my flight instruction schedule around the time that they were in school. Mm-hmm. So flight instruction has given me that flexibility. And then, later on when there were other opportunities, then I could, just take those opportunities on the evenings or weekends when my husband was able to be home with them, which, gave them a good relationship with their father. And that was awesome. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, kind of going back to the beginning of this, not a lot of people really enjoy the education part of aviation, but it sounds like from the get-go, you really enjoyed it. Would that be a right assessment?
Sure. And I think, early on, like any new flight instructor, I went through those times where I kind of got burnt out and doing, the same curriculum all the time with the student. But then I think, and so I was able to take some breaks, which was helpful. And then being able to teach, not just one type of pilot, being able to get into mountain flying instruction, being able to do commercial pilots. And eventually, after you've taught pilots for 2 years, you have the credentials to teach flight instructor applicants, which that's always fun and challenging and a place where I always learn a lot more when I'm teaching flight instructors or people to be flight instructors, pilots to be instructors. I enjoy that. And then I am also in there. We had a part 135 operation at the school. So I got picked to take flights back and forth to the Grand Canyon. That has its rewards as well, in that people actually tip you if they like you.
Yeah, exactly.
If you show them a good ride. And yes. And so you get that extra little pat on the back in that manner. And then some other folks around the airfield found out that I treated their airplanes really well. And so they would ask me to go outside the city and pick up an airplane for them. I worked for a broker who was trading airplanes, and he'd have an airplane, out in Las Vegas, and he'd fly me there to pick it up, or Southern California, he'd fly me there and to meet some so-and-so at the FBO in Riverside and pick up the airplane and bring it back. And of course, the important thing there when you're bringing an airplane back is to, first of all, that not everything is going to work.
Yeah.
But find those things that don't work and be able to give the boss and the mechanics a good briefing on what they do when you do what and what they don't do, and just kind of troubleshoot as best you can with your knowledge of the systems, so that they don't have to spend days troubleshooting and finding out what's wrong with the airplanes before they can turn it and sell it again.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah,
it's almost like you're a test pilot for a flight to get it over and taking all your little notes. Not that you would fly an unworthy or experimental airplane.
Right, and stuff
does
go wrong. Right, exactly. Right, you do a pretty, it's a different type of a pre-flight. You're looking at every cotter pin and every nut. Just,
right.
What is going to come off and cause me to have to not be successful in bringing this airplane back to my boss and to his customer or her customer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It sounds like you did a variety of things.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
It sounds like you got to do almost a little bit of everything. I assume that you didn't end up going to the airlines, or did you?
Never did. No, never did. And, I was able to own a couple of airplanes. I presently own a Turbo Lance, so we can fly it up and over the mountains and get to some more family on the western slopes of Colorado. And my parents still live in Kansas City, so we get to fly out there two or three times a year and see the cousins and the nieces and nephews. And then I had a chance, have the opportunity now to fly, a Citation II jet too with my hangar board. So,
wow. Cool.
Yeah.
So you went and got type rated for that and everything.
No, I just fly it as second in command.
Oh, there you go.
Considering getting the type rating, but he's single pilot qualified in it. But and it's a limited liability partnership there that this aircraft is in. And so the customer likes us to be two pilots if we're going into some complicated airspace and or offshore or something.
Right.
But, you know, my captain's fully qualified, and you know, he's the same age as my daughters, but he also comes from an aviation family, so he's, you know, he's very qualified. I learned from him. You know, he's 20, 30 years younger. He just had his first child too.
And, wow.
So the first, so I'm waiting for my husband to pick me up from delivering an airplane to the other side of the field. And my hangar lord drives by and rolls down the window and says, you're a multi-engine commercial rated, aren't you? I go, yeah, I'm almost totally proficient, but yeah. Okay. You know, ATP'd. Yeah. And he goes, would you like to fly the Citation with me? You know, I'm thinking, yeah, sure, I'll fly it. It's just one of those, you know, would you like to fly my airplane with me?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, sure, of course I would. Well, he gives me a call a few days later. He goes, I've got a trip in such and such date to New York City. These customers have tickets to Hamilton, and they want us to fly them there. And I go, well, sure, I can do that.
Darn it.
Of course, now, of course, now my daughters are grown and have their own places. And so I don't have any family at home, and my husband's still very supportive of this. He's all excited about it. And so we fly these really nice people to New York. They have a wonderful time, and we come home, and the next month they say, well, they're taking their holiday trip to Grand Cayman. Would you be available for that trip? And I'm like, yes, of course I would be.
Man, it's really amazing when you have flexibility like you do to be able to just jump around in different areas like that. Cause I feel like that variety is always keeping things fresh for you, and it's always going to be fun.
Absolutely. Well, and then even in the instruction, I'd never wanted to be that instructor that dumped her students to go, you know, fly commercially or whatever. And so I do let them know that, you know, that's only at the most about a trip a month in the Citation, at the most. So, and I typically get a couple of weeks notice so we can work that around for the students, but I hate it every time that I have to cancel a student for something, because now really the challenge, Chris, for me has become to find out what the pilot's interests are and to be able to, you know, challenge them and work toward their work with what they already have.
Right.
I really believe that all of my students already have all of the talent that they need to be a pilot. It's not that tough, but don't tell anybody, right?
Right.
So, yeah. It's, you know, the most difficult thing is coming out of the three-dimensional world of flight to the one dimension of that runway center line.
Yeah.
But, you know, after 400 or 500 landings, they can do that, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have to remember, hey, you know, the crosswind is going to be a little bit from the right this time, and you've always had left crosswinds. What are you going to do differently? What is the airplane telling you? How can you make that work?
But let the airplane talk to you. So
yes,
that's kind of an interesting point, because I find that here in my area, we're right next to the ocean. We get a lot of people that are fishermen here, and I find that marine pilots are very well prepared to become air pilots, I guess you could say.
Sure.
Aviation pilots, because they know a lot of the wind, and they know how to read the weather, and they're doing a lot of different things that just need to be correlated to what we're already doing. So I think that's kind of what you were saying, was people have a varied background of education, and if we can get to know them and where they're coming from, then we can apply what they already know to aviation, and those light bulbs can go off much quicker. So you were in Phoenix, and then did you go to Colorado from Phoenix? What was the transition there?
Yes. Well, my husband had, you know, we'd bought and sold a couple of practices in the Phoenix area down there, and he was looking for something new and adventurous to do. And he had the opportunity to go to work with the Tsimshian Indians there at Metlakatla in southeastern Alaska. And so, so we went, it's just a little bit further southeast of Ketchikan.
Wow.
Just to kind of put that in perspective for people. Wonderful community. So he and I traveled up there to look at an opportunity there for him to work. And, they've got the seaport there and at Metlakatla. And then they have an old army land-based airport there, which the tribe was willing to fix up for us to come there. And our girls were at a good point. They were just approaching the middle school, junior high years. So I thought that'd be a good opportunity for them to move to a rural area as opposed to being in the metropolitan area in Phoenix. And so we're looking at that. And then we also got an offer in Northeast Colorado out in Haxton, another small town. And with his folks still here and his dad had just taken ill, as much as we wanted to go into Alaska, we thought, yeah, we really need to stay a little bit closer.
Right, right.
And so that's what took us out of Phoenix to Colorado. And the other thing was my husband. At that point, the Twin Comanche was in a partnership and the primary owner had dissolved the partnership. So we didn't have that airplane. And he said, well, if you go to Colorado or Metlakatla with me and bring the girls and everything, I'll get you another airplane. So
deal.
I go like, okay, if we're going to have to live in a rural area, we should have an airplane.
Yeah.
Nobody would disagree with that.
Yeah, definitely.
So we moved there and found the Turbo Lance that we have and seemed to fit the budget and the bill and the family, and it's become a great airplane for us. When you have four people, get a 6-seater airplane. We take a couple of the seats out. We can put our camping gear in there, or pack it full of gas and full of people. And of course, girls don't take any luggage. My family doesn't resemble that stereotype. So. Thank you for laughing. That was meant totally to be funny, but
I know. Yeah. So what was life like there in, you said Northeastern Colorado?
Northeastern Colorado, yes.
That was still rural, right?
It was very rural.
Okay.
The town was about 800 people. The county was about 3,000 people. When I left the very structured flight school in the Phoenix area, it was actually out at the Scottsdale Airport, but anyway, I left the very structured. I wondered at the time if there were people that had their own airplanes in their own pole barns, that they flew them off of their own property or the county roads or something, if there really were people and they didn't ever have any licenses or registrations.
Right.
And Chris, oh my gosh, I found them.
Really? No kidding.
Not a lot. I mean, there was one guy that had all kinds of great aviation experiences and stories, and his son was a talented mechanic and pilot. And one day I asked him, I said, does your father have any certificates? And he didn't speak an answer. He just shook his head. No. Yeah. Okay. We're just going to keep that the way it is. There was nothing that we could have done for that pilot. But some of them, once they found out that I was an instructor, they were willing to come and get some instruction, or even if it was just ground instruction and telling them, what the rules are now. Because this was also at the time, not too shortly after that, the names of the airspace changed.
Okay.
We used to have a complicated system of TERSs and TCAs, and there still are TERSs, but ARSs and controlled airspace. A whole bunch of different stuff that I was happy to forget.
Yeah.
And go for the ABC systems like everybody else has.
I only know the TERSs. I don't know of that history on the airspaces, so that's pretty interesting to hear.
Right. Right. Yeah. Class Bravo airspace used to be called the Terminal Control Area, or TCA. But again, nobody needs to know that.
We've
moved into another millennium.
We don't need to go over all that.
No. And I would probably remember it wrong anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that was interesting. And to share the airspace. And there was a lot of people out in that area that wanted to do it right. And the grandson of this one gentleman, he had an airplane from his family and wanted to learn how to fly the right way and get things done correctly. So he was also a high school student at the time that I met him, and was happy to work with him. And he was thinking that he wanted to be involved in engineering, and particularly aeronautical engineering. So I don't know who actually put out the contest, whether it was actually Metro State University. I think they actually were the sponsors of this contest that they put out for junior high students and high school students. And my girls being in junior high, I thought, it'd be great for them to sign up for this contest. And they could get another partner. And then my student, who's now in high school, interested in aeronautical design, I'll have him be their mentor and their coach for this. And it was called the Burt Rutan Design Competition.
Oh.
And Burt Rutan, yes, was one of the chief judges for this. And one Saturday we'd go to Metro State University in the Denver area, and We would learn what the challenge of the day was. And so for the junior high people, they were to design a spaceport. And for the high school people, they were to design a spacecraft. And our girls, along with one of their friends and my student as their coach and mentor, went through the day, solved all the problems, progressed on and on and on. And by golly, Chris, they ended up winning.
No so, kidding.
Which is what makes it a story. And Clayton then was able to meet Bert Rutan and some of the professors at the university, and eventually got accepted to Colorado School of Mines, and you know, worked his way into to. I actually haven't talked to Clayton in a couple of years. I talked to his dad about a year ago, but yeah, he's trying to figure things out. As his last last word, and you know, it takes all of us a long time to figure out what it is. I went to school and graduated with a degree in sociology and recreation. And never really used that in the sales business, but or in the piloting business.
Yeah,
it was a good background to have.
So. I'm sure we're both deciding still what we want to do when we grow up. I don't think you ever grow out of that. That's just how it is, which is great because you know we get to play so much in the air. So sometimes it doesn't feel like a job. So I'm kind of looking at Haxton here. Where's the nearest airport from Haxton?
Well, Haxton actually has an airport.
Okay.
And one of my customers there, when we first got there, they put a woodworking shop out at the airport and in the big hangar. And then one of my customers had the hangar that was attached to that and wanted his wife to get her instrument rating. So I started working with her on getting her instrument rating. And that was successful. And then we kept our airplane. We didn't keep our airplane at Haxton because we would have had to keep it outside. But Sterling is about 30 miles to the west of Haxton, down Highway 6. And so that's where we kept our airplane in a big box hangar.
Okay, yeah.
And they had an instrument approach there, an NDB approach, and was all that they had to begin with. And then as they put in more and more GPS approaches, we got the GPS approach that, for all practical purposes, took the place of the NDB approach.
Yep, definitely. Thank goodness.
But that's what I used as an excuse to go ahead and get a GPS navigator put into my airplane, because at the time that we bought it, it didn't have any GPS in it. So.
Yeah, well, that new WAS stuff and the LPVs, it's too nice not to have now.
It is.
It's almost
a requirement. And now I was just reading that there's going to... Or they have already started getting rid of VORs.
Yep. They're phasing them out. Getting rid of some of those that aren't utilized as much, I think.
Right. But I do appreciate still having the ADF receiver in my airplane because I can get the ball games.
There you go.
Yeah. Get those it actually points where the lightning is.
Yeah. The poor woman's XM radio, if you will.
Yes.
That's perfect. So, but you're in Colorado Springs now, right?
Yes, I am. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought you said. So when did you make the move there?
That was 2006, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. And then
2005. And then when 2006 is when I started to work for the Peterson Aero Club. Yeah.
Yeah. That was my next question. So that's kind of an interesting location to be teaching because it's kind of connected to the Air Force Base, right? Is that
we are actually on the Air Force Base?
Okay.
Yes, and all of our customers have to be military members or retired or DoD employees. So even Civil Air Patrol members can take advantage of the Aero Club. It is a privilege benefit for sure.
So you have people that are obviously using the Aero Club recreationally. But do you also have people going through and getting their GI Bill instruction sort of thing? Or what kind of people are you working with?
Yes, they definitely can use their veterans benefit, their VA benefit to train here. And my very first student here was a loadmaster on the C-130s from the 302nd down the ramp from us. And he was wanting to get a pilot seat. And when I first came here and started doing the cross country phase of flying, because he'd been out in the C-130s, he knew the training areas and the cross country areas so much better than I did. I learned so much from him.
Wow, that's cool.
In fact, on one of our night flights, he actually brought over down the ramp to me a pair of night vision goggles, and I had no experience with that.
No way.
And yes, and so we're headed out at night, and he hands me these goggles and tells me how to use them. I'm looking at it and doing all the oohs and ahs and wows. And after about 15 minutes of that, I said, "Peter, take these back." I said, "I'm not teaching you anything." Not that I can't teach you anything, but
that's
funny. Just to have that experience, it turned the night literally into daytime for me.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Night. So that was wonderful. But
we don't get so much night here in Alaska.
Oh, right. Yeah, this time of year.
Yeah, it's getting a little better now, but.
Oh, how fun. Yes. So I guess you're just getting out of the time where it was daylight most of the time.
Yeah, really bright. Now we're, now we're going to be creeping up on solstice. But So he was active military and going through training at the same time because he wanted to upgrade from loadmaster to a pilot seat. Did he end up getting there, or is that still?
He absolutely did. Yes. He
awesome.
Put his paperwork and everything. Next thing you know, he's going to officer training school.
Wow.
And he's now, I did this talk with him. He's on a transport airplane. I don't remember if he's he's in one of the bigger aircraft. Mm. It's not a C-130. And I can't remember if he's got a KC-135 or or if he's like all the way to the C-5 or C-17 or something.
Yeah.
I think he's on a C-17. But
very cool.
I have to look back at my text messages with him. But yeah. And even more recently, a pilot that I worked with to get her instructor certificate back in May, she's just finishing up officer training school, and she's got a spot with a guard unit on F-15s.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, she's going that route and just, excited. I'm so proud of her and, worked her way through getting scholarships for everything that she did. And not just getting scholarships, but she also kept up a page where she shared the scholarships and the information. She just put it out there for people to contribute to and add to. So, she keeps paying it forward after all the benefit that she got.
That's great. So when someone comes to you and they're looking to go up into, say, the C-130 or the F-15, like those two examples you just shared, mm-hmm. what's the process like? So obviously would they go through all the normal FAA ratings, or are they disconnected from that at some point to go to officer school? How does it work?
Yeah, I really don't know never having been in the military, but what I hear them talk about is putting together a packet.
Okay.
The one that went through the F-15, she actually networked around and talked with a lot of the different units and kind of found out what their needs were and how that would match for her. And she had to actually interview in. With my first guy, I was still trying to learn the military way and to kind of assimilate myself into that. But he talked, and even the guys now, they talk about putting together a packet. So having that at least private pilot certificate, for some of them and some of their programs, it allowed them to skip the Air Force's flight screening program, where they go in and they get, 15 to 20 hours and just make sure that they have the ability to make it as a pilot before they actually go to the undergraduate pilot schools or pilot training. So my understanding is they have to be officers, either the units, they're already officers and the units put them in to go into pilot training, or the enlisted personnel have to qualify and show that they can become officers and then be selected for the pilot a training program. So there's definitely a selection and a weed out program.
Yeah, definitely.
There is a flight school. Actually, it's a contract organization down in Pueblo, just about 30 miles south of here, where they the Air Force uses that as their primary screening program. The numbers that I recall from, they keep trying to hire me down there, which would be fine, but I don't think I'd have the flexibility that I have up here at the Aero Club, so I rather avoided that. But they tell me that it takes in the neighborhood of like $100,000 to get a pilot through the screening program.
Jeez.
Yes. And if they can determine there that the pilot can make it, then when they put them in the $1 million program in the undergraduate pilot training, if they can be successful there, that they found that that's very cost beneficial, good cost savings. Because if a pilot can't make it in undergraduate pilot training, we've spent toward the end there, they spent almost $1 million on a pilot there with training them in the equipment that they have, the simulators, the you know, the aircraft, the gas that they use,
yeah,
and all those things. So they do try to screen people out before, you know, they make that commitment to train them.
Yeah. Very interesting. It, obviously there's so many people gunning for that dream of being a fighter pilot that there's gotta be some sort of selection process to make sure only the top get to the top.
Well, you know, having been associated with the Air Force here, they are very conscientious about it's their money too. They all pay taxes as well.
Right, right.
And, you know, they want to be good stewards of the resources of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they, of course, they are paying back with their service to the country too.
Definitely.
Taking that oath and willing to go into harm's way on our behalf.
Yeah, and that's priceless if you think about it, you know,
absolutely,
when they get to that level, that's what we rely on them for. So it's worth every penny in my book.
Right, right. My book too. And even to the point where, you know, I talk to center controllers and the controllers about before I fly through a MOA or an alert area, you know, if our service members are there training, if it's at all possible, I don't want to fly through those areas because they will knock it off.
Right.
You know, and they may be at a point where they can't get that hour of training back.
Right.
And, you know, they'll have to repeat it at another time. So I really try to give them that space.
Mm-hmm.
It's beneficial to us all.
Yeah, definitely. So let's fast forward a little bit. And this is the point where you're unfortunately going to have to brag about, about some stuff. So something else happened at Redbird, with AOPA. So share briefly what happened there and then I'll have some other questions.
Well, I got the call from Chris Mosier, who's the head of the flight instructors and the training programs. And I think they're calling it now the You Can Fly program.
Mm-hmm.
He's the director for that. And I got the call and said, you have won the West Region Best Flight Instructor. And I go, wow, how'd that happen? And they have these flight training surveys, that we all can talk, you know, just give feedback about the training that we've had from our particular instructor or our particular flight school that we go to. And, I got, you know, a notice from AOPA that said, you know, some of my students had responded to that. And if I would like to have some more respond to that, give them the last four numbers of my flight instructor certificate and encourage them to do that. I go, you know, what instructor doesn't want to have feedback?
Yeah.
And it's anonymous coming from the students to me. And we still actually haven't gotten the data on that just yet, but I'm expecting that at any time. They can tell me it's coming in. And there were several surveys returned to all of the instructors. I think they, you know, got over 2,000 just on the flight instructors alone, plus whatever they got for the flight schools.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of data so I'm going there to Redbird because I've won this region best flight instructor. I'm like, okay, this will be fun. And of course I knew it. I had asked who the other ones were. And so I stalked them online and their flight schools. And I go, wow, these guys are really awesome. And, you know, they've got some credentials and a couple of them had been nominated before. So and of course, Chris did tell us that we would, of the five of us regional people, one of us has been selected to be the national.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll announce it that day. And so I'm like, okay, I'm not worried about it and look at these other people. I'm just happy to share the stage with them. And so, of course, we're talking about the national because then they did call my name as the national winner. And put up some very nice quotes of some of the things that my pilots had said about me. And I just feel really honored and blessed to have those students that would be willing to put that out there for me. But I truly do. I'm interested in how I can improve. And I typically will ask my pilots at the conclusion of a post-flight briefing, you know, is there something else that you wish you'd gotten from me on this flight? Is there, you know, how can I help you? You know, what comments do you have for me? I've given you comments for you. I just always find out from them, you know, what comments do you have for me? Open that channel of communication, let them give me some feedback so I can do better for them next time.
Yeah, that's a really great attitude to have. And it's actually an attitude that many military people have too, because no matter how deep you get into the military, they do very thorough debriefs when they get back from their sorties. And they are very critical and honest with each other about what could have been better and very detailed. And I think we could do better to bring that into general aviation for sure.
Sure. One of the things I do, Chris, to bring that into my training arena is I tell my pilots, I said, we have no secrets in aviation. I said,
right.
Especially with ADS-B and radar and people looking out, you know, with the window and people's interest in aviation. If we do the wrong thing, somebody's going to see us.
Yep.
I get to do this spin recovery training in an airplane here that is not allowed to do any other aerobatic maneuvers. And I have trained people in aerobatics. It's one of the things that I did back in Phoenix and really enjoyed. And I'm so tempted to roll that airplane. I know it will roll. And I tell my pilots, I just have to hold back, because if I do something like that, that airplane's not allowed to do, somebody will see me.
Yep.
And, and character, they say, is what you do when nobody's watching.
That's true.
Yes. So, it says to be an ATP, you have to be of good moral standards. Mm-hmm. So, now that I have that certificate, and I have had it since 91, I really want to live up to that, and I really want to be honest about that. And again, and just to pass that on to the newer pilots, it's easy to do the wrong thing.
Yep.
It does take character to realize that, you know, you might get by with it once or twice, but you won't get by with it forever. Somebody will see you, and do you really want those consequences?
And I would even argue that it's not so much the people seeing you do things, it's those things that you could be repeating that will one day catch up to you and be dangerous. Say, scud running or departing under your minimums, all those things. Yeah, you're going to get away with it most of the time. People may not even see you do it, but eventually it's going to catch up to you. And that's what I don't want to happen. I don't want to be complacent myself. And I certainly, with just the student instructor relationship, I don't want them to get bad habits from me. So, you know, we're on this whole different level where we're constantly scrutinized and even like a child, it's like a child and a parent, you know, they're absorbing so much.
Yes. And with Apollo, you're going to be so happy that you were a flight instructor before you were a parent, because you've tried out some things. And I was truly blessed to be a flight instructor before I was a parent, because it's all those things that seem to work to motivate and encourage my students. Mm-hmm. You know, they work with my kids too. So,
yep. Try different things, see what works.
Yes. And so now what I try to do too is pass on to my pilots. I said, I'm really trying not to be on the 6 o'clock news. And you were so right, Chris, when you were talking about, you know, you get by with something, you think that is the right way to do things. And that happens in aviation. We get by with certain things so many times, you know, maybe we get by with overstressing an airplane till finally we look one day, we're pre-flighting and a rivet's popped.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh yeah. You know, I did a presentation one time on flying at or below maneuvering speed and talking about our aluminum airplanes, passed out paper clips to everybody and said, my first question is, how many times can you bend this paperclip before it breaks?
Mm.
And of course, now with the whole lecture, I've got everybody bending paperclips. It's awesome. They're involved, right? And the answer is, you know, some are trying to figure it out and some, you know, some are trying to see where I'm going with this. But when we fly above maneuvering speed, we're bending that aluminum. And how long until part of that fail? And the thing that I love about aluminum is it tells me long before it fails.
Mm-hmm.
It will crack before it breaks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rivets will show movement before they actually can't hold their pieces together. I worked for Diamond Aircraft when they were first bringing aircraft over, and we had a lot to learn about composites. And that was really one of the first successful training composite airplanes. You know, they were here before Cirrus and Columbia and some of those. Wonderful structures. But we had to learn not to drill holes just any place.
Yep.
Yes. And, you know, so to those ends, you know, flying in turbulence, below maneuvering speed, the airplane can recover from a stall, particularly if we just, are pulling on one axis at a time, you know, not rolling and yawing and pulling, in all the axes at once, it will recover from that stall.
Mm-hmm.
It won't break. It'll keep us off of the 6 o'clock news, which is another thing I say often to my pilots, you know, let's work really hard never to be on the 6 o'clock news. Let's land on the wheels, you know, of the retractable gear airplane. And cause anything that we do bad, if we scud run and, you know, clip a line or crash into the earth or something, we're going to be on the news.
Yep.
Yeah.
My mantra, my biggest MO is return home to your family every time.
Every time. Yes.
And if that's kind of your guiding decision marker, then you make specific decisions and others not. Not that it's ever really that extreme. I think that it just like flying is a skill and practicing that, I think that practicing safety is something too. You know, you got to practice that decision making. So, no matter what level you're at,
make the good choices. You know, tell your students, tell your family, tell your children as they're growing up, make good choices. I trust you to make good choices. Now I've looked you in the eye and told you I trust you. Are you going to violate that trust? Most likely not.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So I know that you're a popular woman. You have a women in aviation thing. Actually, 99s, is that right?
99s.
Yeah, 99s thing to run through.
Mentoring session tonight. Yes.
Yeah. So with you being able to kind of digest this, not only regional best instructor, but national best instructor over the last several weeks, what would your, what's your advice and perspective on people wanting to get into aviation and what it takes? And if this is a good time, what are your words of encouragement?
You know, follow your dreams. You can do this. Look at all the hundreds of thousands of folks that are pilots at this point. If they can do it, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Find an instructor that'll work with you. Be that information harvester. And probably the easiest thing you can do is do your written tests early. Okay.
Yeah.
So then you've got that foundation of information of what you can know what you need to know at that point. You don't really know how to use that material from just working on the written test, but you know, get that foundation early, and then you can build on that. And then as the time comes to take your check rides and to build the flight experience, you'll be ready to go in that, and you won't be waiting to the last minute to get those results from the written test.
Yep. And you know, I kind of, with your words, I think one of the biggest jobs as a flight instructor is to take the average everyday person and find out what makes them extraordinary and connect them to flying and how they are going to get this done. One of our biggest jobs is to just show them that that can be done, and to help them believe in themselves. And when that light switch goes on, you know, whether that's in the discovery flight or the solo, or maybe it's the last stage check or even the day before check ride or the check ride.
Yes.
Once it goes off, then people have the passion and the drive to just keep going. And it, you know, people like you that are high quality instructors that have helped so many people in the past get there. Just a treasure in the community. And I so honor people like you that have decided to take on education in the community as your career, because it's more valuable than I think anyone gives it credit for. So I really appreciate all you've done.
Yes. Well, and I appreciate what you do, Chris, by putting the word out there with your podcasts and your websites and the materials that you're developing. That's huge. You know, people need that. And that's where we can reach, pilots.
Exactly.
These things. This is a wonderful forum. So thank you so much for the privilege of talking with you this evening. And I can't wait to tell all my friends about it being on Saturday.
Perfect. All right, Zoanne, it's such a pleasure meeting you in Wisconsin and, of course, catching up with you here. And if I'm ever in the area in Colorado, which my sister actually lives there, it would be fun to fly together sometime.
Oh, so that would be great.
Maybe that'll happen.
I'd love to show you
someday.
Around, and I'd love to get up to Homer. And learn what flying in Alaska is about. So.
You're welcome anytime.
Thank you.
All right, Zoanne, I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Good day.
Yep, bye.
Join us next week for another exciting topic or interview with a great guest. All AviatorCast resources can be found at aviatorcast.com. Subscribe to AviatorCast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, YouTube, and other podcast services. Did you enjoy the show? Review AviatorCast on iTunes or similar service. If your review is aired on the show, we'll send you an official AviatorCast t-shirt. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Write AviatorCast at me@aviatorcast.com to introduce yourself or to ask any questions you may have about aviation. Now, for the final release clearance, back to Chris Palmer.
It just so happens after Zoanne got this award, she is quite the popular lady. So I really appreciate her taking time out of her busy schedule, not only teaching students still, but also with all the speaking engagement she's been getting and all the public attention she's been getting, to come on the AviatorCast and share a couple thoughts with us. You know, some things that stood out to me was that Zoanne had a unique experience as a mother going through flight training, in that she had to find a way to get that to work. It sounds like it's such a serendipitous thing that ended up happening with her students and their families, the way they were kind of helping watch her children while she was instructing. But I just love also seeing people like Zoanne that have stayed in the education industry their entire careers. They're just so solid, and I really look up to them and their mentors like mine. So Zoanne, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know that others will really appreciate your contribution as well. And congratulations on your National Best Flight Instructor Award. And I'm sure that there are many more great things coming to you, much more karma that is coming back to you. So best of luck in your future endeavors. Of course, thank you, the listener. Yes, you. I'm talking to you on the other side of this podcast. Thank you for all that you do. I know that you guys are kind of out there on the front lines. You're going through your training right now. You're trying to find a way to make it work with finances and time and family and everything else. I know that it's not easy. I know that you can find a way to get through it. If there's ever anything I can do to help you guys out, make sure to write me at aviatorcast.com. Of course, you can reach out to me on places like Instagram. I'm very active there. Not so active on Twitter anymore. I think that's kind of a dying platform, but I do come around there every now and again. And of course, we're on Facebook as well. But you can also just write me directly, again, at me@aviatorcast.com. You guys are awesome. Keep up the work. You'll get there. And until next time, throttle on.